I'm Christopher Lydon, looking at Tea Party tax rebellions then and now with the very hip modern historian of the 18th century American Revolution, Jill Lepore, in her Harvard office. Is history repeating itself in this 2010 campaign revolt against Obamacare and the rest? Are we perhaps just looking at a reenactment party in periwigs and three-cornered hats? But even if this Tea Party today is a sort of right-wing marketing show, what does a historian, that's you, Jill Lepore, make of the real discontents in our country this fall? This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. Give us historians, Jill Lepore. Summon the ghosts of Samuel Eliot Morrison, Henry Steele Commager, and their like to put today in context. You know that colonial rebellion against the British Redcoats backward and forward from the 1760s and 70s. Make the link to today, if there is one.
There certainly is one, but I think that the Tea Party movement of today has less to do with the 1770s than with the 1970s, finally. I think its sense that it has all to do with the 1770s is basically wrong. The movement names itself after the dumping of the tea in 1773 in Boston Harbor. People dress themselves like people who lived in the 18th century. They quote the founding documents. They quote the founding fathers. They want to cherish the Constitution. They say again and again, the time for revolution has come again. There are these very casual and easily made connections drawn between the events of today and the events of the 1760s and the 1770s. So, and that, from a historian's point of view, is kind of nonsense. But it is, I think it's very inspirational for ordinary people who are involved in the movement, who care a lot about history, and I think that's very genuine. And but the ideas that they have about what the American Revolution was about are considerably at variance with what scholars would say the American Revolution was about, I think, more or less uniformly.
Where do you see wrong selections, especially the heroes being made? The different places of John Adams, say, or Sam Adams, or Thomas Paine. What does that tell you?
The fates of all those people have risen and fallen, and the reputations of all those people have risen and fallen over the centuries. I think Paine's story is the saddest, because Paine's Common Sense, which was published in January of 1776, really did propel the colonies to independence. He made an argument that ordinary people could read and understand, and he made it so forcefully and so beautifully in this just very artful and powerful piece of writing. And he was very much celebrated for that at the time. He though, thought of Common Sense as part of a trilogy. He went on to write The Rights of Man when he was in England, and Age of Reason when he was in France in prison. And he always thought of those three books later in his life as a trilogy. But by the time he wrote The Age of Reason, he was writing very much a critique of institutional religion. You know, Paine who famously said, "My own mind is my own church." By the beginning of the 19th century, even before Paine died, when he was much maligned when he died, he was basically renounced by all American contemporaries, including Jefferson, who had been very close to him. Jacksonian Republicans make toasts to Common Sense but renounce the Age of Reason. You know, there's this, Paine's basically disavowed. But what then gets resurrected of Paine is only Common Sense, so that you can have like Jerry Falwell quoting Common Sense and Glenn Beck, you know, writing a book called Common Sense, and Reagan quoting Common Sense. Many prominent evangelicals referring to Common Sense frequently, as if Thomas Paine never wrote The Age of Reason, as if you could just pick and choose a few quotes here and there. And that, you know, that only has gotten worse in this kind of Google way, where people just really just literally cherry pick quotes from the 18th century. And they're really looking at like five guys, as if the only people who lived in the 18th century were these five guys. And then you kind of just pick the things that they say that prop up your own political position and move on. So that, I mean, one of my favorite moments recently was this summer, Sharon Angle, you know, the Tea Party candidate, running against Harry Reid. Reid had accused her of being too extreme and being, you know, far too socially and fiscally conservative for the ordinary voter to even really consider, which is, you know, the latest Democratic strategy in these midterm elections. And she gave a press conference in which she said, well, you know, the founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, people said they were too extreme too. People said they were socially and fiscally too conservative. And, you know, that's just the tradition that I'm carrying on. It's like, and you sort of picture these reporters at the press conference like, kind of screwing their eyes, you know, puzzled by this remark, but not really having a counter to it. Like, geez, is she right about that? I don't know. You know, scratching their heads. No, she's not right about that. Thomas Jefferson was not accused of being too conservative in his lifetime and therefore unelectable. I mean, Jesus. The guy was campaigned against by Adams as being an atheist. He was not accused of being a social and fiscal conservative. He didn't suffer for that in his election. Like, but somehow... people just kind of hold these guys up like human shields. I mean, it's gotten to that point where you can really just kind of wave the hat around or the piece of parchment or, you know. My other favorite shameless act is George Pataki in founding this organization, Revere America, last spring. He came to Boston and stood in front of this statue of Paul Revere, this equestrian statue of Paul Revere, and said, you know, we need to venerate our founding fathers, and the country is again in danger, the same kind of danger that Paul Revere warned the people of Massachusetts against in 1775. We're in danger from healthcare. It's like the historian in me. Paul Revere was never famous in his life for that ride. You know, Paul Revere is a myth made by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow in a poem written in 1860 to rouse Northerners to fight the Civil War. Longfellow was an ardent abolitionist. The whole poem is about slavery. He just liked Revere's name, and so does George Pataki. But none of this has anything to do with the American Revolution or whether the Founding Fathers would be opposed to health care, because the whole question, what would the Founding Fathers do, is a question that comes from religious fundamentalism. What would Jesus do?
It is so quasi-religious. I mean, not only what would Jesus do, but this notion, and it's in the Old Testament too, God is not pleased. I mean, God is angry. His Israelite children are misbehaving or whatever. Does every country refer back to some touchstone of absolute political authority, or is that an American thing?
That's a good question, and I don't know. I mean, my father-in-law, who's a Yorkshireman, he is very proud that there is no written constitution in England, and he will go on and on and on about this. That is our problem. You know, that he's now an American citizen, but he feels very strongly that this was the Faustian bargain, that we, you know, that the constitution was actually written down is the worst thing that ever happened to the United States. In his very jaundiced view, we always have this debate. I think there is something distinctively American about this particular problem, because we are a nation founded in revolution. And a nation founded in revolution that cherishes stability will always have an anxious relationship with its own past.
One of the most interesting sort of observations in your book, it seemed to me, is a kind of neurotic thing that comes with being a child of revolution. And the fundamental impulse, as I read you, is that sort of one is enough, and we're not going back. We'll cherish it, but we're not going to do it again. Or even sympathize much with other people doing it again. Haiti, for example, or Vietnam after the World War II, for example.
Yeah, and of course, you know, the Constitution was an attempt to sort of shore up the unruliness of the revolution and was incredibly effective at that, at kind of setting the very fragile experiment in Republican government on a stable course. And the party system that evolved in the wake of that introduced a different kind of stability. But every political movement, every new party looks to the revolutionary period to seek political authority. That's sort of just how our political tradition works. So every partisan argument kind of comes down to that, and the debate between the Union and the Confederacy. Or if you think about the Lincoln-Douglas debates, no, we own the Constitution. No, we own the Constitution. Or, you know, I tell the story about the busing debate in the busing riots in Boston in the 1970s, all about the Constitution. The pro-busing people saying they have a kind of constitutional authority to do this, the anti-busing people saying this defies the Constitution. This is pretty much how our politics has worked. And so there's nothing really in that sense new about this contemporary political moment with the Tea Party, nor I don't think is there anything especially cynical about it either. It really is just kind of part of how we manage that anxiety.
And this is why we still love three-cornered hats, to give people authority. No, I'm in touch with the Founding Fathers because I'm wearing one of their hats. Yeah. Or something.
Yeah, yeah. That's different because the last 30, 40 years we've seen the rise of heritage tourism, which, I mean, there has always been a kind of comic book version of American history that is just out there. Mm-hmm. It is way more juvenile than it ever was before because of heritage tourism. I mean, for-profit operations that sell an experience. Mm-hmm. Ooh, it'll be just like it was then. That's what they sell. Or, you know, these kind of I think doorstop founding fathers' biographies sell the same thing. They traffic in that same thing. Oh, their problems were just like ours. You're going to understand this guy because he's just like you. That collapsing of the distance between now and then is the currency of our popular history, and especially of heritage tourism. So I think that has actually introduced some kind of a twist on what used to be really just a kind of rhetorical move, right? So now we're just going to dress up and we're going to wave these people around, and Sharon Engel's going to say, well, the founding fathers, they had the same problems I did. You know, it's not surprising that she would say that. That is the lesson that all heritage tourism and pop, you know, the really bad popular history teaches.
Jo Lepore, you have been out there in the movement, exercising what Simon Sharma calls the archives of the feet. I mean, just sort of smelling this movement on Boston Common with Sarah Palin and lots of, you know, the Green Dragon Tavern, named after the original Green Dragon Tavern where the revolution was hatched, but you're in there among the folk. What do you make of them? Austin Hess, for example, or Kristen Varley, all sorts of interesting contemporary characters are part of your book. Do you believe them? Do you like them? Are they for real? Do they know what they're doing?
I think
do they like you?
I think they're completely for real. And I really liked them, actually. I doubt that they feel fondly toward me, but that I find that frustrating. But
as long as they buy the book.
This is what... No, they're not going to buy the book. You know, I'm not a journalist. I'm a historian. But the Tea Party movement started in February of 2009. And when that happened, when this rant heard around the world was issued to start tea parties to oppose the economic policies of the Obama administration, I had just started teaching an undergraduate class on the American Revolution here at Harvard. I hadn't taught that here before. I taught a revolution class when I taught at BU years before, but I hadn't taught the revolution here. I taught courses about the revolution, but not a course called, like, the American Revolution. And I decided, you know, I want to take my students out to Boston. We'd really do kind of Boston stories because it's just so much fun to teach that here. And I love just, you know, taking them to graveyards and, you know, we'd go to the Old South Meeting House and Old State House. So we'd go I kind of read the newspaper in the morning. There'd be people in tricorn hats saying it's time for revolution has come again. Then I'd go to class and I would, you know, talk to my students about, you know, the work of Gordon Wood, I guess, against the work of Bernard Bailyn, and where was the interpretation now and how are we to understand, was it the urban artisans that led to the revolution or was it the influence of Locke and classical republicanism? And we would have these, you know, seminar meetings, and then we'd go on these field trips, and then I'd go home, and on TV there would be these people again in their tri-cornered hats. And months into this, everybody kept saying, could you please write about the Tea Party? Will you please write about the Tea Party? I'm like, this is interesting. Let's sort of let it unfold. I'm writing, you know, I teach the 18th century. And then Scott Brown was elected a year into this movement. And I just thought, okay, I don't understand how this was such a compelling candidate for voters of Massachusetts. I understand how Martha Coakley was completely not compelling, but I was really interested. And I think the Tea Party rightly claimed success for the election of Scott Brown. So I just thought, well, okay. How often in one scholarly career do people out on the streets care about what one teaches? I mean, other books I've written are about this obscure 17th century Indian War in New England. No one's ever heard of it. I wrote a book about a 1741 slave rebellion in New York. No one's ever heard of it. I go talk to people about things that I've written about. No one's ever heard of them. People have heard of the revolution. And suddenly, like, actually, people really care about it. So I went to these meetings at the Green Dragon Tavern, which is where the local chapter of the Tea Party was meeting at the time. And I was just deeply curious about what had brought these people into this political movement and also how they understood the relationship between their Tea Party and the dumping of the tea in 1773. And I would say, you know, everybody I spoke with was, you know, uniformly friendly and open. And I mean, they were concerned, like, why does this Harvard historian, what am I after? But they were really open and eager to talk to me. And a lot of different things brought them into the movement. And they have genuine concerns. And most of them just seem to me like your garden variety Republicans, and who were maybe especially angry about the pretty embarrassing state of partisan political discussion on the national stage. And my whole family is Republican. So every dinner conversation I have ever had when I visit my family, all my siblings, my parents, is a political argument. And that's that's actually how I...
Is your family overtaxed?
Yeah, my family's overtaxed. But I live in Texas.
What comes off the page, Jill, in those encounters with the Tea Partiers today is extremely nice, affable people. We know lots of them, suburban Americans, a lot of them migrants from other parts of the country, decent folk, but with a disconnect that allows them to identify themselves with people who were in the 18th century under, at times, a brutal occupation by British foreign forces. They're very, very comfortable folk in today's rebellion. But furthermore, Austin Hess, for example, works for Homeland Security. He comes out of the defense industries. It never once occurs to him, I think, that we might be the redcoats now. We're the folks who occupy places.
Yeah.
We're armed to the teeth with weapons that he's built. There's been an inversion here, and he hasn't noticed it.
Well, I think, you know, he is a smart guy and a good man. I mean, I would want to hear how he would answer that, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I think that it certainly is the case that the long-standing tradition of the embrace of the tradition of the revolution as a anti-war movement is something that he is not impressed by. You know, in the 60s and 1960s and 1970s, anti-war activists dressed up as revolutionaries. You know, John Kerry marched the Paul Revere's ride in reverse on Memorial Day in 1971. Vietnam Veterans Against the War occupied the Lexington Battle Green that year and said that they were doing so in the spirit of the men who had died there in 1775. And that claim is certainly reasonable. The British were occupying Boston from 1768 forward, and a big piece of the rhetoric of the revolution was opposition to a standing army, an army kept among people who were free in a time of peace, or an occupying army of any sort, that liberty and a standing army were opposed to one another. And that political tradition, that rhetoric, is what the anti-war movement seized. Part of why Austin Hess can be involved in this movement now and see no conflict is that, of course, once the war began, Washington realized you couldn't actually win a war with a bunch of anti-war activists, which basically were the colonists were, you know, and a bunch of guys who said, yeah, well, we got a musket and we'll come out and fight if it's really called for. But other than that, we're a peaceful lot. You know, he's like, well, no, we actually got to raise an army now. And so the kind of rhetoric of the citizen soldier who was opposed in a republic to a standing army had to be put to one side while the war was fought. And then after the war, there was a whole different set of debates about. So if you look, if you're looking for support of a position opposed to an army or to, you know, what we would now call the military-industrial complex, you can find many sources in the 18th century. But if you're looking for the other thing, you can find that too. It's a time of debate. It's the most fertile political debate in the modern world, really, those decades in the 18th century, not just here, but in Western Europe as well. So you can find support for a lot of different positions if what you're looking for is support for your position as opposed to going into the past to study it carefully. So
the question in my mind is, how do you get around the founding notion of the United States as an anti-imperial movement? It all came back to me in a book by one of your colleagues, Niall Ferguson, called Empire. Came out right in time to send the troops off to Iraq in 2003. The message of the book was, you know, we've kicked ass around the world long enough. We Brits, it's your turn. Get out there. Take up the white man's burden and all that. I mean, literally, it was in there. It's your turn now to police the world. Go to it. The cover of this book, Empire, had a beautiful old picture of British gunboats firing incendiary rockets into some poor little town for the glory of, you know, rule Britannia. And I looked again. I said, wait a sec. That's Charlestown, Massachusetts. That's Bunker Hill. That's where we're
That's
from.
Us.
That's us under those guns. What are you talking about? And I asked him. Of course, they changed the cover.
Uh-huh.
But there is a big role reversal here, and the Tea Party wants us to ignore it.
Well, the Tea Party has a very selective view of the past. It also has a very selective view of what constitutes its movement. So one of the things I was really struck by, everybody I've talked to and people I've spoken to since, because I've gone and done, you know, book talky things and people in the Tea Party will come, they do not want to talk about foreign policy and they do not want to talk about social issues. So these things are basically off the table. And I once had a student come up to me, well, I think he was an undergraduate, came up to me when I was even thinking in Washington a few weeks ago, and said, I really like your talk, and I'm really interested in the Tea Party's, you know, evolution as a political movement, but what I really want to write about is Tea Party's foreign policy. And I said, you know, good luck, because there isn't one. It's not...
Well, there is a bit of one. Ron Paul is an anti-imperialist in the old mode, you know, Congress declares war, basically bring the troops home. I mean, he's an old-fashioned and to me, not unsympathetic isolationist. There's a foreign policy in at least the father in the Paul family. No?
No, that makes perfect sense. But, Ron Paul is not the Tea Party. I mean, one of the reasons there is no foreign policy is there is no platform. You know, and everybody in the Tea Party will say, we don't have a leader. We're all about devolution. There is no Tea Party. There are tea parties. We share two or three things that are really important to us, and they're about reducing the size of the federal government and getting out all the incumbents and going back to the Constitution. And maybe this kind of 10th Amendment stuff would be, I would say, almost
universal.
No more
gay marriage either.
You know what? I see that all over the Tea Party, but there are plenty of people in the Tea Party who disagree with that.
Jill Lepore, when I look at the Tea Party, I see nothing but confusion. Confusion in their own heads, and they've maybe taken the wrong title. But it seems to me a failure also in the Fourth Estate to analyze what they actually are up to. It might actually be a kind of psychoanalytic adventure to sit them on the couch and discover what the anger really is all about. It's almost inconceivable that they don't have a foreign policy or that they don't force themselves to make a connection between us as the greatest military power the world has ever known, spending more on arms than all the rest of the world combined, the distortions of that simple fact on everything in the society, including neglect of schools and roads and other such. What do you think the movement is actually all about? I mean, what is it telling us about our world in 2010?
That's really hard to see. I'm not sure that anyone living now can see that. It is the contribution of a historian to offer a long view, and implicit in that is the assumption that our close-up view will always be out of focus. So I just sort of dispositionally believe we can't really see most things unless we have a long view on them. So I kind of believe that everything that everybody thinks about the Tea Party right now will be one day proven wrong, including what I think about it. And that's what history teaches us, is to be humble about how we see what we see, because people will see it differently soon enough. I do think, I'll tell two stories to answer this question about my own sense of the question of perception. One is that in the spring, when I was working on an article for The New Yorker about the Tea Party in April, and right after it came out, a reporter from USA Today called. They had some new polling data and they wanted some spin on it. And she was a lovely woman, and we chatted for a while, and she said, well, you know, tell me about... Please compare this movement to other right-wing populist movements. Is it just like that? And this, by the way, is the central problem with historical punditry, right? Everybody wants, it's just like the heritage tourism. How is now like then? That's the only question anybody ever wants answered, which is, from a historical point of view, a really bogus question. So I said, well, you know, I don't really think it's like, actually, in fact, I didn't go into my rant about this, the flaw of this question, but and its ubiquity. Like, no one wants to hear anything from historians except for this question, the answer to this question. But I said, you know, in fact, this was just thinking on my feet, you know, I think it's less like a political movement or a third party emerging than it is like a religious revival. And here's how, because just the way it's structured, you think about this, if you think about the Erie Canal and those itinerant preachers going along the Erie Canal as the canal was being built in the 18-teens and 20s, town by town, those towns getting set on fire up to Utica and such, you just kind of see this fieriness and this burst of stuff. You have that similar kind of charismatic spine of leadership basically at Fox, you know, where you have Hannity and Beck stirring up a kind of real intense emotional fervor, and what people are being asked to kind of be reborn into is treating history like a religion. And Beck in particular has been very explicit about this. You know, the founding fathers are divinely inspired. We have forsaken them. The founding documents are holy writ. They speak to us the way Jesus speaks to us in the Gospels. These are things that he has said and would say. And she was, you know, this reporter was like, wow, I've never thought about that in this way. It seems to me like a political movement. You know, tell me more. She was, you know, open to my interpretation, but and I don't know what she ended up making of it. But then this summer, you remember there was this Restoring Honor rally that Beck hosted in Washington, which was basically a religious revival meeting and was explicitly said to be such, and it was supposed to be this depoliticized meeting. And suddenly everyone's like, oh my gosh, the Tea Party has a lot of religion in it, and it looks a little bit like a religious revival. and then people suddenly bought my argument that it was like a religious revival. But it does kind of work that way, and that's hard to see because I'm not sure that people in it even feel that way about it. But my follow-on story is, so I was at the National Press Club on a panel about the Tea Party a few weeks ago, and Dick Armey was on the panel, who runs this organization called Freedom Works. You know, he's the former House Majority Speaker with Newt Gingrich. He wrote The Contract with America. And I was told the audience would be working journalists, but in fact, the audience was entirely people from Freedom Works, whom Armey had brought, and wearing their Freedom Works T-shirts. And we had a really interesting discussion, and at the end of it, a bunch of the Freedom Works people, who were very lovely people, a lot of them would come for the weekend because it was the 9/12 rally, and they're from Texas and Oklahoma, and a bunch of them came up and talked to them for a long time, really liked these people. And this one very nice woman said, you know, I was really surprised in your remarks. You know, I enjoyed what you had to say, but you called the United States a democracy, and, you know, it's not. And I said, gosh, you know, if it weren't a democracy, you know, you and I wouldn't be able to vote. What do you mean it's not a democracy? And she said, well, I mean, it's a constitutional republic. And I said, well, no, it's democracy. And she said, well, have you read the 5,000-year leap? And I said, no, I mean, I know about it, though. And
I don't. What is it?
Oh, well, I'll tell you in a second. And so I said, she said, well, you got to read the 5,000-year leap. And I said, okay, but then you need to read Sean Wilentz's Rise of American Democracy. And I said, I'll make a deal with you. Like, I will read the 5,000-year leap if you read the Rise of American Democracy, because the rhetoric of classical republicanism, on which which guided the founding fathers and how they thought about drafting the Constitution and erecting our system of government, you could see it all over the Federalist Papers, is of course quite important. But without the Jacksonian Democratic Revolution and universal male suffrage, not to mention the 19th Amendment, we would not, in fact, have the right to vote, and we would not live in a country that I think this woman would be very happy to live in, since she would be completely politically disenfranchised. So I was sort of trying to convince her of this point. But she was immovable on it because she had this faith in this book. So the 5,000-year leap is a book by a guy named Cleon Skousen. And he worked for Hoover in the FBI and was the founder of the Utah chapter of the John Birch Society. He was later disavowed by the Mormon Church. He had a theory of history that the founding fathers were divinely inspired, that the Constitution was revealed religion. And
that's incredibly interesting, just to see the Tea Party as a religious movement fundamentally, or a quasi or pretend religion. And it may be plausible. Can I ask you a different question, though? I'm puzzled that I think for want of thinking through their doctrines, the Tea Party and the way it's covered have made no connection with left-wing Tea Partyism. I've been rereading Henry David Thoreau as a kind of Tea Party soul, basically, of the left. I mean, he went to jail against the Mexican War, essentially, refused his taxes, but said a lot of things the Tea Partiers say. Emerson said Thoreau had this maggot of freedom and humanity in his brain. Thoreau himself refused to vote at the polls. He said, I wish to record my vote here in my journal. But he bellows from time to time things like, why the United States has never performed an act of justice in its life. I mean, he was totally anti-government, anti-tax sort of rebel in a different spirit that I think is alive and well in the country today. I'm also thinking of Chris Hedges, very left-wing now, harsh sort of doomsday critic of the United States. But he likes to say that there are no major institutions in our country, including the press, the educational system, the financial sector, the labor unions, the arts, religious institutions, especially our dysfunctional political parties, that can be considered democratic in the sense from the bottom up, truly voices of you know, unmarshaled people. So it seems to me there's a big zone of that malaise or unhappiness in the country today that would have to be called fundamentally left-wing. Why does the media focus entirely on the right-wing hotheads in the funny hats?
Well, that's about 9 different questions right there. So let me just start with the media question and move backwards towards...
We're going to come back to media, too, and the death of newspapers then and now.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that part of the answer to that question is the Tea Party has a very good story. The Tea Party is a great name. You know, the name itself was a joke when the Tea Party was called the Tea Party in 1834, because it wasn't called the Tea Party any time before then. But and it was funny then. It's not so funny now, but now it's taken very seriously. But it's a very good fit with our anti-intellectual soundbite age, right? To just have a costume and a name and a single political point to make. It's also the case that the rise of the Tea Party in 2009 was exactly simultaneous with the death of the newspaper. So what I think happens during that period, I mean, the newspaper and American democracy go hand in hand and always have. The newspaper was born as with American democracy. And, you know, in the 19th century, you cut your ballot out of the newspaper. So it remains to be seen how American democracy works without the newspaper. We are in a period of disequilibrium that is the consequence of the death of the newspaper. And I don't buy that the newspaper lives on. I mean, I think we have – the newspaper is dead. What there is now that is called a newspaper is something completely different than the newspaper
It died
was.
In the 18th century for because of the Stamp Act, which hit printers especially. It's dying for entirely different reasons.
Completely different reasons. But the consequence here is really – what I mean by the death of the newspaper is the death of the editor. So, you know, there used to be some group of people that would decide what's going to be on the front page. And these were people who had, for all their faults, a certain kind of perspective. What rises to the top digitally is, you know, it's like the evaluation of who is the most important person in your senior class based on who gets the highest number of signatures in the back of your yearbook. If you think about your high school senior class and think about who had the most signatures in their senior yearbook, I don't think that was a measure of anything. So what rises to the top of coverage, media coverage, which is not determined by editors anymore, but is determined by clicks and numbers, is this story. And so there's no sense of proportion, in other words, in the covering of the story. All sense of proportion has been lost. So I think the story about the Tea Party, if I were to predict years to come when someone actually has a proper vantage, unlike all of us who really don't know what we're talking about, it could very well be about this is a consequence of this political disequilibrium having to do with the shift from a print to a digital news reporting. Getting back to Thoreau and the left, I mean, there is a long, you know, certainly not limited to Thoreau, tradition of dissent that has either kind of anti-government or anti-tax argument, or certainly that looks to the revolution for its inspiration. You know, I was really struck when I was working on the book. I had completely forgotten this, but the Martin Luther King in the Letter from a Birmingham Jail writes about the Boston Tea Party as the first act of civil disobedience. You know, so Gandhi in the Great Salt March in the 1930s says this is just like the Tea Party. This is like the Tea Party they had in Boston, Massachusetts in the 18th century. The nonviolence of the protests has very much been embraced by the left. When Sarah Palin came to Boston that day last April for this Tea Party rally, I met a whole bunch of people from the Catholic Worker who were there in 18th century costume. They were out from Worcester and they were passing out leaflets that were opposed to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And their whole point was
the ultimate left religious peaceniks.
Their whole point was we can wear these costumes too. And then they were kind of waving around Trenchard and Gordon's opposition to a standing army and, you know, pamphlets from the 17th and 18th century that to their mind girded their position. And certainly, you know, in many ways it does. And, you know, I gave those guys a hug. Like, I was actually just so glad to see them. And turns out, like, one of them knew my father. Like, you know, I'm Catholic. So I was like, I'm just really happy you Catholic people are here. But, you know, it's not that that doesn't exist, but it's of a different nature. So where was I going with this? Oh, I know. I was also going to talk about our capacity to imagine the different ways in which people in the past have understood the revolution or the Constitution is quite limited Because, again, like when you think about Sharon Angle saying this malarkey about that Thomas Jefferson was called a social and fiscal conservative, no one answers back to that, partly because historians don't want to be bothered. But whenever, you know, I see these people waving around their constitutions, I just think about William Lloyd Garrison. You know, July 4th, 1854, Framingham, Massachusetts, massive anti-slavery meeting, stands at a podium beneath an American flag, draped in black and hung upside down, at a podium draped in black. And he gives this speech, the Constitution. He's got a copy of it, big parchment copy of the Constitution. It is a covenant with hell. And at the end of the speech, he sets the Constitution on fire.
Oh, my God.
And as it burns, it falls to the ground in this pile of ashes. And then while he continues his speech, he grinds the ashes under the heel of his shoe while the crowd calls out, Amen, in rapturous catharsis over the rejection of this document that made possible the continuation of an institution that even many men who signed that document were horrified by. They were horrified by their own complicity. I mean, there's just wonderful things that people at that convention say about what it means to make that compromise. I mean, so when I see these guys waving around this Constitution saying, you know, like as if it's a talisman, as if we're going to repeal health care because I have this document in my hands. How come we don't know that tradition of dissent? I mean, you think about the other thing. I really thought a lot about Thurgood Marshall when I was writing this book because, you know, in 1987, think about this moment, right? It's after the Reagan Revolution. Evangelicals have really become a moving force in American politics. 1987, Robert Bork is nominated to the Supreme Court. It becomes this big debate about originalism, which is relatively new. You know, people who are originalists will say, you know, the founding fathers were originalists. So they were not. But originalism is being bandied about and discussed. 1987 also happens to be the 200th anniversary of the drafting of the Constitution. And Thurgood Marshall, you know, first African-American on the Supreme Court, guy went to Frederick Douglass High School, you know, argued in Brown versus Board of Education. He's asked, you know, to give a speech on the occasion of the bicentennial. Everybody else is giving these rousing, you know, thank God for the founding fathers, this, the kind of the ascendance of the right and its argument against the new left's embrace of ordinary people as a different story of the 18th century is all about embracing the Constitution and deriving all of your political authority from your reverence for the Constitution. And Thurgood Marshall at this speech just says, you know, I know a lot of people are going to be doing this year, making a blind pilgrimage to the National Archives, more or less to worship at the feet of this document. I cannot join them. What I will celebrate, what I am willing to celebrate this year, are the 200 years of suffering and struggle that have gotten us to where we have gotten past a document that was defective when it was written.
Wow.
He took a lot of crap for that. But that...
He was a sitting justice.
Yeah. That is an American tradition, too.
Can I try out an idea for you to puncture as a knowing historian? It seems to me the big story here, this is a little bit of Chalmers Johnson, but the thought that the United States has become such a huge, not to say monstrous, global military superpower, 800 or 1,000 bases around the world, that we are so unrecognizable in those original terms that we resort inescapably to every kind of denial, euphemism, maybe dress-up fantasy games or play-acting of all sorts to just get away from our anxiety about that, I don't want to say betrayal of our history, but departure from our roots. And we'll make up all sorts of stories now to dull the pain.
Well, Richard Hofstadter got there before you and said more
Chalmers
or less
Johnson
the same thing.
Long before me,
yeah.
Too.
You know, Hofstadter agreed that all populism, left or right, is about history. It is about the conspiracy of history. It is about the need to see in the past a time that was better than the present. And you can rally a lot of people around that idea, especially people who are unhappy about something big, like at this moment, this, you know, difficult recession. For Hofstadter, you know, who was so interested in paranoia and conspiracy, what he saw in a certain kind of populism was the idea that history itself is a conspiracy against you. And that operates sort of interestingly now in this moment because for the Tea Party, it's actually the academic investigation of the past that's a conspiracy. You know, the left has taken over the academy. They're teaching not only at universities but all the way down, you know, to our children, even in kindergarten, they're learning this kind of left-wing lunacy. And, you know, Beck will say, remember our children being indoctrinated. this is a distraction from your question, but your question, you know, I think about it as a kind of nostalgia for a simpler time. And if what would be comforting to you is to think about a simpler time in American history, it's easy to pick the 18th century. Because what in the 20th century is going to look simple to you? What in the 19th century? You can't just ignore slavery and the Civil War. It's going to look simple to you. But the 18th century, you got these white guys with their white wigs and their cute hats, and they're like toys. It's not an accident that period in American history seems so simple and innocent and straightforward. And that's because most people learn about it in elementary school. You don't actually learn about the revolution in high school. People don't generally flock to classes on the revolution in college. For most Americans, it's taught third, fifth, and eighth grade. You kind of cover the events of the American Revolution. And it has a kind of storybook, fabulous quality to it. And I think it's a kind of wonderful story there. It's a kind of civics lesson. And it's, you know, Grant Wood talked about it as a kind of folklore. I mean, if you think about that Grant Wood painting, The Midnight Ride, that, you know, depicts the...
Right. Maybe you memorize The Midnight Ride.
You memorize the poem. And it's a beautiful poem. It's a beautiful painting. And Wood wanted to be playful about it. And he felt, you know, this cute sort of childlike view of that painting. It's so beautiful that way. That, you know, that if we embrace this stuff as a kind of American folklore, then it's wonderful. But what's going on right now is that people are taking this kind of folklore story as if it is literally the truth, and not only literally the truth, but the foundation for every political argument that can be made. And that and then it kind of moves into this religious sphere, and then all hell breaks loose.
Hmm. Richard Hofstadter was also the one in your book who pointed out in the 60s and 70s that what we ached for was a narrative, a story, which is always my question to any historian. Like, give us the big picture here. And let me pose that as the last big picture question to you. If the Tea Partyites stand up and say, it's 1775 again, and we got to throw off that yoke of a tyrant and his taxes, it happens to be Obama this time, et cetera, and here we go again, let's get ready. And it was your turn to say, no, here's a bigger way to see where we are in the larger course of things. What would you tell them? I think people really desperately want to know.
I think people do desperately want to know. And, you know, it is a little bit like the problem that Democrats always have come campaign season. They never have a good story to tell. And Republicans always have a good story because they don't mind it being simple. And it's straightforward and it's satisfying. And Democrats always want to say, no, it's more complicated than that. And that's no answer. It's an answer, but it's not a satisfying answer. I think that, you know, what Hofstadter was distressed by, among many other things, was that in the 60s, when there was so much conflict and so much awareness of groupness, and one group fighting against the other, that historians had come to study groups instead of studying the whole. And now there is a kind of, oh, you know, we're post nationalism now, and it's intellectually fashionable to be all about globalism and transnationalism, and there is some sense that if you were to try to tell a story about a nation in this kind of that you would be betraying the intellectual contribution of someone like Benedict Anderson in Imagined Communities, who argues about the constructedness of national stories, and that therefore we're, you know, as intellectuals we're sophisticated, and we, you know, we want to disavow that's propping up power, and that's separate from our own vision, and, you know, you'd reveal yourself to be sort of a simpleton if you were to say, I want to tell a national story. This would be the kiss of death for you to be taken seriously as an intellectual. Well, I think that's unfortunate, because there are plenty of people who will say, I don't need to be taken seriously as an intellectual. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you a national story.
But there are a lot of readers on the street too who are wondering, are we Rome? Are we over? Are empires toast? Or is there a way to rescue it? I mean, simple but day-to-day bread and butter questions like that. What do you tell them?
What do I tell them? Can I tell you just one little story? See,
please.
I always end up telling a story, and then people say, no, you've told a story. You haven't actually made a
big
argument.
That's why you're Jill Lepore.
Okay, so Anthony Lucas, in 1975, published a cover story in New York Times Magazine called Who Owns 1776? Terrific reporter, also great cultural critic, also a great historian, one of the few reporters who could actually see historical questions as they unfolded. He went around every little dinky organization in Boston that was telling a story about the revolution during the bicentennial, including like some anti-busing group that was called itself One If by Land, Two If by Sea. And he went and talked to the new Museum of Afro-American Heritage, and the guy there said, you know, it's 200 years of the white man stepping on the black man, and everybody had some story about the revolution. He ended the piece with saying the story of the revolution is there is no story anymore. There is what there is a political free-for-all about the story. I think that is really where we still are. And it would be great if historians could find a way, not, I don't think, necessarily to tell a story about the revolution that we can all use again anew, but a story about what we mean as a people. And what I think that reading Lucas made me think about, at the time he was writing that piece, he was just finishing a book about Watergate, it's called Nightmare. I think when I read Lucas's piece, what I see in all those people, and in the people today involved in the Tea Party movement, if we take our, you know, most generous and compassionate look at this organ, these are people who want to have a dream. And what they have is a nightmare. This is the turning away from, and instead of looking at the now, right, which as you were sort of suggesting is kind of an intolerable present, right? Like think about the moral complicity of our foreign intervention, et cetera, right? The economic woes, these present day problems riven with strife, the whole blue state, everything's kind of a mess. As people say things on the television every day that are grotesque. It's a very yucky present in many ways. It is not unlike that moment in 1975, after Watergate, after Vietnam, civil rights still painful, when the whole country feels like it's in the middle of a nightmare. What people want is a dream that is forward-looking, and what the Tea Party is a dream about the past. I don't think a historian can offer a different dream about the past. That's not our job. And it is the job of politicians to offer a dream about the future. Wasn't that what Obama was? That's his whole Dreams of My Fathers. It's about the dreaminess of America. You got to keep talking the dream, though.
In the rise and fall or rise again kinds of trajectories that are always pretty clear, you know, 1,000 years later, 2,000 years later, whose job is it to tell anxious people what the direction might be? Is this an empire coming apart? Is it actual resurgence of conversation, agitation, politics, argument, all those good things that could fire up the game for another generation, another century even?
Well, it's clear that right now who's doing it is Beck, right? Who's offering that? And that is what's so appealing for these people who want that. It's clear that Obama is not doing it, right? And people expected that he, in fact, would. So
that is a big part of the story, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is a big part of the story. He has this animating, forward-looking, reform-minded compassion that he was attempting to offer is not something that is coming out daily from the White House. And I had a talk yesterday to a bunch of retired people, actually. And one person got up in the question and answer and said, you know, what I'm wondering is, are we looking at the death of compassion?
There's a serious question.
And I thought that was a great question. Because where do you see anybody promoting compassion? Right? Like who has a bully pulpit is actually promoting compassion? And this is good an interpretation of the current political moment as any I can think of. It was a very a thoughtful remark.
I guess I wonder why the mainstream media can't even imagine framing it that way. It's so convenient to cast this as sort of wacko people in funny hats doing something obviously nutty, and rather take a serious look at a polity that's got lots and lots of troubles and say, let's get serious here.
You know, it is absolutely a failure of that conversation. And just as someone who has often been asked, especially recently, to comment on this, Nobody wants to hear something moderate. Even if you look at the opinion page, no one offers anything up that's based on evidence or careful analysis. It really is just all off-the-cuff opinion. I hear constantly from people, give me something that I can use against them. Tell me something they do wrong or something they're stupid about, because I want to be able to use your book against them. Or, you know, and then, of course, I hear from people within the movement who say, you know, you've got us all wrong. You were out to get us. These are all cheap shots. as if no one can imagine that someone's motive is to offer a thoughtful analysis of something going on. Like, it's actually unfathomable in this media climate that there could be someone who is actually really trying hard to think hard and write carefully about something. Because where is that going on? It's not actually in the toolkit of political discourse anymore.
More's the pity. Was there ever a kind of national shrink that we could take, you know, an unhappy country to and say, doctor, let's work this out. Let's figure out what the big problems are, what the little problems are, what the old problems are, what the new problems are, what the treatable problems are.
No, and I'm not so down with that. That's what we need. I think we need more publicly engaged intellectuals, and we need a public that's more interested in listening to what intellectuals have to say.
Starting with you, Jill Laporte, thank you so much for giving us this time and this wisdom and these laughs and these insights.
Thanks.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till you feedback on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.